that's a piano in need of tuning at Central Methodist Church. And I believe that note was a B, but I'm not the expert. Bram Wynans has been tuning pianos for a long time. His face is relaxed and his movements are swift as he maneuvers his intricate tools, a small lever and a wedge, along the piano's pins and strings. He plays each key at least a dozen times.
Depending on what kind of piano you're working on, at some point you have had enough. No, I mean, you could always tune. I mean, your ears don't change. God willing, I can hear like I do for the rest of my life, but if I had an older age, we'd start to go deaf, then it would be a problem. So hopefully that's not going to happen.
Bram Wynans is here in the studio this morning. He's stealing away from tuning pianos to talk about what he does and how he relates to making music. We'll hear from a horn doctor and a luthier, that's someone who makes stringed instruments, later in the discussion. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome to Central Standard, Bram.
Thank you.
What we just heard, was that a pretty typical scene from your daily life?
Yeah, well, during the day anyway. I'm also a pianist and I perform at night. I do gigs. But yeah, during the day, that happens a lot.
I want to talk to you about that because, yeah, you're a jazz musician. And I'm curious how you think the work you do with instruments during the day as a technician and repairman, craftsman, how that relates to the work you do as a musician and performer.
Well, it actually relates the other way. Me being a pianist also relates to how I do my technician work.
Yeah, how they relate back and forth.
Well, yeah, I've been thinking about that, but I think it only relates primarily one way for me anyway.
That's interesting.
Whereas when I'm working on an instrument, that I want it to be able to function for the high-level piano playing.
For the musician.
Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as you're working on a piano as kind of contributing to that musician's work? I mean, that you are, I don't know, kind of like an invisible collaborator.
Exactly. And I realized that early on when I was in the conservatory and, you know, you do gigs and you do jazz festivals and stuff, and the pianos were always in horrible shape. And you realize, like, you know, these pianists, what they have to deal with. So I always carried a tuning hammer with me to make sure that at least I could get the worst out of it before we would have to start performing, because sometimes it was a real mess. So, yeah, I do realize the function or the part that you play and the importance of it as a technician.
I want to learn more about you and your background. First of all, I hope you don't mind my saying that I love your accent. Where are you from?
I'm from Holland.
And what brought you to Kansas City?
Well, I was performing with Deborah Brown and Richard Ross. They're two jazz singers from here. Deborah Brown still lives here and, you know, still performs all over the world. Richard Ross died in 97. We did a lot of tours and festivals, concerts in Europe. Deborah Brown was teaching at my conservatory at the time.
How did you originally get into jazz?
That is something that is probably, you know, a couple of different parts to the story. The first jazz I ever heard was a record that my father had of reissued recordings of Django Reinhardt in the Hot Club de France from the 30s. And later on, I heard Barrelhouse Blues, Boogie Woogie, and Fats Waller play. And that's really when I fell in love with stride piano.
So you fell in love with jazz by hearing great jazz musicians. What was the beginning of your own training musically?
The beginning was just, you know, like general music education. You learn how to read and, you know, simple theory, you know, just what kids do on the piano, you know, beginners. I went through all of that.
So just a kid with piano lessons?
Yeah.
How did your interest as a musician and as a listener and just profound appreciator, how did that start translating into a technical interest?
I think the technical interest did not just come from being a pianist. The technical instrument or interest probably came more from my father being a physicist. And he was in the area of physics called aerodynamics and jet streams. So he had a lot to do with sound and sound generation.
Huh.
And they were also making all sorts of measurements. This is early 70s at the university.
That's interesting.
On sound waves and how they behave in different, you know, from different type of sources. It was very interesting.
That is super interesting because when I think about instruments, I mean, that's such an, you think about those artistically, but to think of them from a perspective of physics and to think of the air that moves through an instrument as similar to an air that would move like, yeah, in a jet stream.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that comparison?
Well, really, if you look at music theory, what we also teach at, you know, UMKC, we also talk about theory. It's numbers. Frequencies are numbers, you know. There's a lot of, especially in an instrument like the piano, a lot of mathematical equations have been made in order to design and construct that type of an instrument. And not just from an acoustical perspective, but also mechanical. If you look at the piano action, it has to be balanced out right because a piano action is nothing more than a collapsed beam. But the way they collapse it and the way it's supposed to function, that's where the real intricacies come in. It's very interesting.
I think that it would help me understand what you're saying a little bit better to if I could hear you talk about the anatomy of a piano and how a piano is constructed. I mean, this is an object that functions in a specific way, and a lot mm-hmm. of us take it for granted that you hit a key and a sound comes out, but how does it work?
Well, that's kind of, let me try to explain that. It's kind of hard to do that without a visual.
Visuals, yeah.
But basically, you have the piano key, which is a beam, and in the center of the key, it's balanced. It's what we call the balance rail. So the key, when you push it down with your finger in front of the key, the back of the key goes up. So it balances in the center.
How is it balanced?
Well, it's balanced, you know, close to the middle of the key itself. So it's really a beam or a lever. So you push it down with your finger where you play it. That's the front of the key. It goes down. And therefore, because you have the balance rail, it sits in the middle. The back of the key goes up. This is, okay, well, this is in the case of, actually, it's both grand pianos and uprights, okay? Now, depending on whether...
So, like, kind of like a seesaw, if you push down on the one side, the other side goes up.
Uh-huh, yeah. And then on the back of the key, where it goes up, there's a whole construction, the mechanic, you know, the action is what we call it, where then it's a part in the action, we call that the whippin'. And within that is what we call a hammer jack. It's a jack that's being pushed up against the hammer butt, is what we call it, which is connected to the hammer shank and the actual hammer. So the jack is pushing up. It's a movement going up. But then it's pushing against the part of the action that pivots. So therefore, you get a lot of travel out of the hammer so you can hit it hard if you want to or if you need to. If you need to play loud, the hammer moves a lot faster than the jack comes up. So then the hammer hits the string, and that's what creates the sound. The string basically is like the principle, same as with a lot of stringed instruments, is where you have a string, and that runs over a bridge, and the bridge is glued to a soundboard. It's like a violin or a guitar, and the soundboard amplifies the amplitude or the vibration of the string.
When you listen to music now, do you hear instruments and their condition as much as you hear musicians and their talent and their artistry?
Yeah, sometimes I hear a combination of one affecting the other, you know. You can have a wonderful pianist playing on a piano that's in very bad condition, and you can hear the frustration coming through as well. if the piano is really nice, then really the artist has a lot easier time to perform on that instrument and to get out of it musically what needs to come out of it or what the artist is trying to say musically.
What do you like about what you do? Is there something really cool about coming in and working with people's instruments that maybe an outsider wouldn't think of?
The cool part about it is just basically the way the piano has grown and is designed, you know, through the centuries. And I think it's really cool the way people think about mechanics and, you know, sound production and how they come up with solutions to problems. And you can see that a lot just by looking at a piano action. I think it's really interesting.
What can you learn about people by looking at these pianos? I mean, do these objects and their surroundings or maybe even the condition they're in kind of tell you a story about how this object has related to people?
Yeah, well, even if it's an old piano, it's in very bad shape, you can still see basically how the piano originally was designed and constructed. And so you could still see that. It's kind of fun when you look at that and you bring something like that back to life and you realize that the person that built this piano is long dead and gone, but the piano is still here and, you know, you're still working on something that's been, you know, constructed with a certain idea in mind.
Yeah. Is there a story from your own work life that kind of illustrates that, like a restoration, maybe a full restoration job you've done?
Well, yeah, there's plenty of stories. recently, I did a full restoration project for it. They moved into town, and the movers had they dropped the piano off the dolly, and the piano basically fell apart. It was a smaller piano, but you know, it was a family thing, and it was a really nice little piano. So. They were going around, you know, checking for bids. The moving company originally was just a furniture moving company, and their standard policy of, you know, reimbursement was $300. And
wow.
I talked to them and said, you got to realize this is a musical instrument and all these intricacies. That's a lot of labor and work that, you know, now it has to be, you know, that's why it's so expensive because it's a piano. Anyway, it was all resolved, and so they awarded me the work. But what the most rewarding part was is that once there's a couple of things that happen. You restore a piano to a condition where I would say, as a pianist, okay, I like to play on this thing. You know, that's the first thing. That's my benchmark. When I work on something, I want to try to get it, in spite of the quality of the instrument, I want to try to get it as good as I can get it and where I can be happy playing on it, at least, you know. The second part is when the piano came back to the customer, you know, she started crying.
Just with joy that it had been restored?
Exactly, because now she could finally play it again because they were battling this problem for maybe a year and a half.
Did she see it as the same piano when it came back to her or as a slightly different piano?
No, it was the same piano, only it was probably in better shape than it was before it got damaged. Also, because I took care of some regular maintenance that hadn't been done in years.
Is there a totally objective idea of what like perfect condition is, or are there idiosyncrasies? And this might sound really cheesy, but like, would a piano have like its own personality that what's perfect for this piano might be kind of unique?
Yeah, that's probably more the case, where different pianos have their own personalities. It also depends on the brand.
How do you assess the personality of the piano and know what this piano needs to be its best self?
Well, the first thing you do, of course, is you play it. You want to, you know, see what it feels like when you play it. And that can tell you a lot of things about what's going on in the action and give you some initial ideas as to what you can do different, regulate, you know, in order to make it play better. Of course, you check the tuning condition. That's standard. You also check the sound character. depending on the, you know, the hammers that hit the strings, they are covered in felt, and the felt is being attached, or the hammers are made by really with a machine compressing the felt very hard, you know, on the actual wooden hammer. You know, they glue it to the, so the felt goes around it, but they compress it. And depending on how much compression they use, it changes the hardness of the felt. Now, some piano have hammers that are as hard as rock, and they sound horribly tinny. So it depends on, you know, I mean, if it's my piano, I always like it a little fuller and warmer. You know, it also depends on what the customer wants. But there's all sorts of different things.
Bram Wynans, jazz musician and piano technician, it's been really cool getting to know you.
Yeah, thank you.
Central Standards off to a short break. When we return, we'll meet a specialist in stringed instruments, as well as a self-proclaimed horn doctor. Later in the show, we'll talk about the fan base for women's sports. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. We've just heard about the poetics of piano tuning. Next, we're going to get to know horn doctor Mike Corrigan. But first, let's go with Sylvia Maria Gross to Mike's shop in Olathe for a taste of what he does.
A horn shop is a pretty noisy place. And it's not just trumpet players testing for sticky valves. If you go behind the store to the workshop, you'll find it actually takes sound to make sound.
Sound is very much a part of our world.
Mike Corrigan calls himself the horn doctor. He shows me around his 5,000 square foot warehouse, which is tucked away in an industrial park in Olathe. Hundreds of instrument cases are piled everywhere. Corrigan flicks a switch next to an old bathtub where instruments get cleaned. Even that involves some noise.
Mike, what are we hearing? What's that noise?
That is the sound of an ultrasonic cleaner, which is what you'd expect to find in a small jewelry store to clean jewelry, but it's obviously a lot larger for musical instruments.
What do you think of Sylvia's observation that it takes sound to make sound?
It was a pretty good angle on it. You know, we work in these shops all day long and take so many things for granted. But I remember listening to that story, and it was kind of interesting to see from the outsider looking in just the variation of sound that happens in the shop while we're making instruments. It's pretty cool.
You are also a musician. When did you first get into music?
I started when I was in sixth grade. I got a little bit of a later start than most of my friends in my area. I grew up on the East Coast and, you know, like a lot of musicians, started playing in school and began on trumpet originally.
Yep. What did you know the second you started playing that this is something that you loved and connected with, or was there a rocky start?
No, getting a later start may have actually helped kind of kickstart the energy, my musical energy, if you will, because I was so excited and badly wanted to join the band. And when my parents, you know, had this opportunity, they said, "Hey, you know, do you want to join the band? We think we can get an instrument for you." I was very excited. I remember the first day, vividly bringing the trumpet home and sitting on the floor of my room playing who knows what, you know, but I just had a blast doing it.
What was it about the horn in particular that you think spoke to you?
I think what did it for me is when I was young, watching the movie, the old Jimmy Stewart movie, you know, it was called Glenn Miller Story. And that movie really stuck with me my whole life. And I couldn't decide at first whether I wanted to be like Louis Armstrong and play trumpet or Glenn Miller and play trombone. But
Those are pretty good choices.
Yeah, yeah. It was kind of funny that movie stuck with me. You know, looking back at it now as a kid, you know, this old, you know, black and white movie originally, and it was great.
What was going on in your own musical career when you started taking this interest in the horn as an object that needed to be crafted and that needed to be repaired, and that you found that work as
right.
an career.
Yeah. Okay, so this is an interesting story, and it still is when I was quite young. My neighbor across the street was also a trumpet player. He was several years older than me. And I remember a day he came home, and some woman from church had given him three trumpets. And we all went over to his house, you know, to play. And on the floor, he had sprawled out four, you know, his own trumpet and these other three. And I think that's, you know, different people have moments in their life where something just ignites. And that might be the musical hoarder in me. I wanted to have four trumpets badly. And the repair thing started quickly after that. We had a young student at our school that played clarinet. His name was Scooter. And he told me he really wanted to play trumpet, but that the trumpet the family owned didn't work and that their family had a clarinet, so that's what he ended up playing. So I, of course, was trumpet player and convinced him to give me the trumpet that didn't work. They had brought it to a local music store, and the cost of repairing this trumpet was going to be just too high for the family. So he brings the trumpet to me, and I bring it home, and I was just so in awe of how could I figure out how to get this trumpet to work. So that was what I spent days on, and it came to me by there was a hole punched in the piston of this trumpet, and it wouldn't play because there was a massive air leak. And I had the idea, why don't I just stuff something in the hole? It was just as simple as that. So taking a piece of styrofoam and plugging up that hole, and I believe it was 7th or 8th grade that this happened.
Wow.
And I put the piston in, and it played like a dream.
So. There, it does sound like there's a bit of a scientist in the instrument creator and instrument repair person. What are some of the skills that go into working with and making horns? I mean, I think there would be a little bit of like sculpting and welding.
Yeah, there's a variety of skill sets that are involved with a variety of musical instrument manufacturing. And what specifically inspires me is working with metal. I really enjoy working with metal. You know, string instruments and woodwind instruments, even they all have a lot of their own science behind them. So what I specifically work with is brass instruments primarily. And there's just a lot that goes behind to them. The tapers that are involved, the volume of air, that affects the volume of air that goes through the horn. If an instrument gets a dent, you know, depending on how bad the dent is, that'll definitely determine how the horn plays. It could be real bad. Solder joints, you know. So the skill sets involved with working on brass instruments are just having a lot of patience. And it's very similar to sculpting, like you say, when you're doing dent work, moving the material back and forth and having a good eye, you know, having a specific ear is definitely a positive attribute with things like tuning pianos. You need to have a really good ear to be able to hear what's going on. And that does play a role in what we do. But
can you see sound when you look at an instrument and its shape?
It's interesting. There are a lot of different tones and timbres that'll come out of different brass instruments. And for a brass musician, the instrument is much more a part of the musician's sound. You know, that's something that a musician's going to take with them wherever they go. You know, it's kind of difficult to take certain larger instruments with you to play a gig on the street. But with a brass instrument, that is an extension of their musical voice. And there's a lot that goes behind what will produce certain sounds, depending on if a musician wants a dark sound for a nice jazz solo, doing something more of a ballad type versus maybe a salsa musician that wants a really piercing sound when they're playing.
After Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, you brought your horn doctoring services to New Orleans to help the musicians there get back on their feet. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, that was an amazing experience. I had, previous to that first trip to New Orleans, never been to New Orleans before. And seeing all of the footage on TV and hearing the news about such, you know, horrible devastation down there, I wanted to do something to help out. And At first I was looking at different organizations I could donate money to. And then it occurred to me, you know what? I want to make sure that whatever I contribute is definitely affecting musicians down in New Orleans. And the best way I thought to do that was just to go down to New Orleans and fix instruments, because that's the skill set that I had. And I knew it was a needed a needed thing down there.
Did you forge relationships with the musicians you met while you were doing this, and do you maintain those relationships?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of crazy. In hindsight, looking back at it, that first trip just established so many incredible, lifelong-lasting relationships that still today we keep in touch with these musicians. And that was a great, you know, effect of going down there. Certainly not the intention of doing it, but the musical people down there and just the community was so well-receiving of that first trip down there. It's been great to continue that.
How much do relationships factor into what you do in general? I mean, there's a huge technical and physical side of this, but what's the human side?
Well, that's a good question. You know, musicians, like I was saying, their instrument is an extension of their musical voice. So there is certainly a lot that goes behind the design of an instrument and building an instrument for a musician. But also, a lot of musicians have a close attachment to their instrument. And I describe it to people as kind of an important piece of history that they might own, like a family heirloom sometimes. But you cross that attachment, sentimental attachment, with maybe a really close pet. But it's really deep connection that a lot of these guys have with their instruments. And it's really important that they feel comfortable with their instrument. Sometimes if they drop their horn, it may not necessarily be out of alignment or have anything wrong with it, but some musicians are insistent. They want to get their baby checked out. You know, I want to make sure she's okay, you know, because I dropped it out of the case last night at a gig, and, you know, I just want to make sure. And there's definitely kind of an emotional connection.
Mike Corrigan, owner of BAC Horn Doctor, that's Best American Craftsman Horn Doctor. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
And now, just when you thought we could not possibly have another instrument repairman in the studio, we have a luthier to introduce. Anton Kreutz, good morning.
Good morning.
What is a luthier exactly, and am I saying it correctly?
Yeah, it's a luthier, and it's a person that makes string instruments.
So talk to me about your interest in stringed instruments more generally.
Well, I started repairing and working on string instruments when I was 12 years old. So it's been sort of a yellow brick road for me to be working on them. And after I graduated from high school, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And I went to actually a four-year trade school for it, for violin making. And then after that, I went
Where was this trade school?
It was in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Interesting. Is that kind of like a known place within the field?
Yeah, it is. It's a known school. There's only three schools in the country for that, and this was one of them. And I researched them, and I, you know, preferred that one.
What kinds of skills do you learn there? I mean, 2 or 3 years, that's a very deep immersion in understanding a specific kind of object.
Right. The main thing that I found out, ironically, that they teach you is hand skills, and because once you graduate from the school, you make this box with strings, and it looks like a violin, and you know, you call it a violin, but it takes a long time before you continue making instruments where you actually make this an instrument that people start falling in love with, and it takes a lot more knowledge than just the hand skills, and so that was the main attribute of the school. That I realized, even though it's a violin making school, you're learning how to make this box with strings, but it takes a different level to start making really, really an instrument that the musician falls in love with.
Talk to me about your family a little bit. Do you have a musical legacy?
We do. My mom is a violinist, and my father's a bassist, and we grew up in, was born in Leningrad, Russia, now St. Petersburg, and my grandfather was actually in Leningrad during the siege of Leningrad, and they were friends with Shostakovich, and he was there during the siege. And when they got the Leningrad Symphony from Shostakovich to Leningrad, he was organized the premiere, and was the concertmaster of the symphony there that premiered it on the day that the Hitler said that the city would fall. Then that's when they premiered the symphony, and literally weeks later, the Russian front really started crumbling for the Germans there.
Did you Is this a story that you grew up with, like kind of informing your idea of what music means kind of in society?
No, they were completely different. That was on the family side, uh-huh. and that was our family tradition. When I was younger, I was not thinking about music at all. I was thinking about the art because I was always making models and doing pottery. When my father took me to a violin shop where he had the instrument repaired, and there was a violin maker, and it was actually, you know, here in downtown Kansas City on Truman Road, and I saw somebody for a living working with their hands, and I go, I didn't know you can do that. So that was the inspiration for me to to start seeing that there can be a life other than these standardized fields of, you know, accounting and things that you do, you know, that when you graduate from college, that you can work with your hands. And so when I was younger, the entire incentive for me was the craft.
If you had to explain to someone in just a few sentences mm-hmm. how stringed instruments work, could you give that synopsis?
The basic idea is that the strings vibrate the bridge, and the bridge, like a seesaw, goes back and forth. It pushes on one side where there's a bass bar, a bar underneath the top. The bar goes down, then it pushes back up. Then it pushes the bridge as a seesaw on the other side, and then there's a little post that's on the other side, and that post pushes on the back. And the back plate then goes down and then pushes back up. And so what's happening with the back plate, it's like a trampoline where this little post is pushing it up and down. And in the process of the back going up and down, it is sucking air in to the openings that are called the F-holes, and then it's pushing the air out. And the power of the back vibrating because of that post gives that violin incredible power that it can fill a whole concert hall, versus a guitar really can't, because it doesn't have that post vibrating the back and using the back plate as a trampoline, so to speak.
Let's just say we're talking only about violins. How big is the range of styles and models, and how different is it to work on one versus the other?
The violin has been standardized since the time of Stradivari for several centuries. And the reason it hasn't changed much is because during the time centuries ago when it was designed, what they were using at that time was geometry based on the golden section and the Fibonacci sequence. And
so that's what we, you know, harmony comes from that.
Exactly. That's how light evolves sound. It evolves the frequency waves and
the rings around onions.
Yeah. And so, exactly. And so the model was based on spirals and that geometry, because at that time they viewed geometry as divine. And so when they built cathedrals or they built musical instruments, it wasn't just like eyeing it all, you know, make a line here, a line there. Everything was done according to geometry. And of course, when you do a cathedral that way, it has acoustic properties that are great. And when you make an instrument that way, then it has also acoustic properties that are great. And so you can make instruments that are wildly different, but then they sound worse because the modeling happened to be based on this divine proportion that really produces the best sound. And that's why the models have stayed consistent for all these centuries.
Are you able to bring creativity and originality to this work in spite of, or maybe even working with this idea that there is a specific way for a violin to sound good?
There's originality in the standpoint of little changes make a huge difference. You can change the thickness of the plate by a tenth of a millimeter, change the sound. Ironically, the goal of violin making is to get to back to what Stradivari did, and the finish has an immense amount to do with it. And so, a great part of my life, when it comes to violin making, was spent on creating a finish that produces that same quality of sound that the Italian instruments had.
We live in such a telecommunications-based world, mm-hmm. just full of intangible information kind of flying around us. Most of us don't come that much in contact with the physical sources of the sounds that we hear. We see us like a speaker, and that's mm-hmm. it. What's the role of a hands-on craftsman who works with instruments very tangibly, like in today's world where most things operate by simple binary code?
Well, I think that when you have an acoustic instrument, it produces a different level of emotion than when it's coming out of a speaker. You know, the physics behind that, you know, more complex, but I think the nuance of the sound waves coming out of the string instrument really affect people emotionally. And I view emotion like the ocean, and feelings are like the sea level. So you won't know really what's going on, you know, inside the ocean until you see the sea level. And the bowed strings always are producing a huge emotion, and more so when it's live.
Anton Kreutz, owner of KC Strings and Kreutz Strings, it's been such a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
We spoke earlier with piano guy Bram Winans and horn doctor Mike Corrigan.